Welcome to a new season of The Good Glow. I hope you're well wherever you are in the world, here in Ireland, over in the UK, walking on a beach in Australia, running through a park in America, or traveling the world. Thank you so much for tuning in, and I hope you're going to enjoy my podcast today with Nicola Haney. This season of The Good Glow is brought to you with thanks to Electrocell, a simple way to keep on top of your hydration. Not just for athletes, Electrocell is for anyone who wants an easy way to stay hydrated. Whether you're at work, out for a walk, or just getting on with your day, it can also be used to stay hydrated in hot weather. It's available in three flavors. There's always one that's perfect for you, with a mix of key electrolytes like sodium, potassium, and magnesium. Find Electrocell at your local pharmacy or visit electrocell.ie for more. Electrocell is a food supplement and should not replace a balanced diet. Always read the label before use. Okay, so over to Nicola Haney. Lots of you will know who she is. She survived domestic abuse at the hands of her ex. Her book, Stronger, What Didn't Kill Me, Made Me, is a number one bestseller. Nicola met Garda Paul Moody in 2017. Just before she met him, she defied all odds by surviving a stage 4 cancer diagnosis and was just getting her life back on track when she returned to the dating world. Nicola thought all her dreams were coming true when she met Paul, but little did she know she was facing into a new nightmare. After months of dating, Paul began to show signs of abuse with threats and violence. The abuse got so bad that over a 14-hour period in July 2018, Nicola received 652 messages from Paul Moody, which were described as threatening, vile and abusive. In July 2022, ex-Garda Paul Moody was jailed for 3 years for coercive control, one of the first people in the state to be convicted of this type of abuse. Coercive control is a persistent pattern of controlling, coercive and threatening behaviour, including all or some forms of domestic abuse, emotional, physical, financial, sexual, including threats. I have left important phone numbers in the show notes. Today, Nicola speaks to me about that time. We also discuss how we were connected long before her name became known all over the country. But this story does not define Nicola. Her cancer does not define her. She is a strong, brave, beautiful woman. She's a mum, a daughter, a friend, a sister, and a soul sister who's changing the world. Nicola Haney.
I'm finally here.
You're finally here in the same place where I heard your name for the first time so many years ago, which we'll get into later, how our paths crossed and how we were connected years before the public came to know you or your story. It's such an honor for me for you to be on The Good Glow. Thank you so much. And we've developed a little bit of a friendship over the past few months, haven't we?
Absolutely, yeah. I always knew this day was going to come. Absolutely. I just knew. I knew years ago before we even met each other. I just always knew. I think even there's going to be so many girls that I haven't even told yet that I'm actually coming on to it. I thought I'd give them a little surprise.
I love that. And I suppose it's so hard to explain. And we'll get into kind of the details of how I first came to know your name, which was actually in a Garda station, and how I never had contacted you, but I hoped that in me telling my truth, I was helping you in some way. But tell us about the Nicola. And look, when I read your book, I couldn't put it down. I read it in 2 days under my duvet with a torch as Jamie slept beside me. I just couldn't put it down and I cried so many tears, Nicola. And there's so many women, I'm sure, who can relate to your story. But tell us a little bit about the Nicola before cancer and before Paul Moody came into your life.
Yeah, I think I was always a positive person. And I love girls, I love women. I think that's why I was a hairdresser, because as soon as I went into that industry, I was just surrounded by women and fashion and makeup and clothes. I worked in Henry Street, so Topshop was my shop at the time before Zara ever came. And I would never have a penny because we'd be out after work having a few cocktails, having a few drinks. I don't even think we could afford cocktails then. And putting all the tips together. And I loved walking in Henry Street, the buzz, the action, all of it. And life was great. I have to say, life being a hairdresser, I don't have any regrets because I've met my best friends in the world in my very first job I ever started in Henry Street.
And you're still friends.
We're still best friends.
Wow. And like what came across for me as I read about your life before cancer was that you were really strong and independent. And I think that stood to you as the terrible times came around, is that you had a real sense of knowing who you were and you knew you were strong inside. Would I be right in saying that?
Yeah, I was. I always felt like a strong person. I think because, I don't know, my mum had 10 children and I just was her helper. But I was always a bit of a worrier too. Like if my mum went to town on her own, I would like think I have to go with her to protect her in case something happened to her. I always had that. I always remember that. So I'm learning loads about myself. And as we all got older and we all moved out, my apartment was always the place where everybody in my family, friends, everybody, I'd get a knock on the window and everybody would come. So I just, that's who I was since a little girl. That's the role I always was in my family.
Where did you come in the family? Because there's 10 of you, right?
Yeah, there's six. So I was the sixth and there's four younger ones to me. So it was actually like there was two families nearly in our house because there was the older ones that went to work and there was the young ones and I was one of the younger ones and that went to school. So there was nearly like, we got fed half and half at one stage and the other ones, we get fed before the older ones come in from work. So that's just the way my mum had to do it. But yeah, it's mad when you grow up that you do realise these different things, that the type of person you are. I think you don't know it and you don't understand it until I think you've done a bit of work on yourself to where this came from.
Yeah, and I just said to you actually the quote, Angela Burke, what Angela Burke said on the podcast was that life can only be lived forward but understood backwards. So it's like you have to live your life forwards, but then it's only when you look back that you can actually understand it. So when you found out that you had cancer, how old were you?
I was 36 and I honestly did think, like, I just was single and I thought I'd broke up with a guy, a really nice guy. And I actually was a bit heartbroken, but I thought that was the worst thing that could happen to me at the time. And obviously I was 36, I come back from a holiday and I found a lump,
And how long had you been with him for? So did you think he was kind of your happy ever after?
Yeah, he was a guy I'd met on holidays in Ibiza and I was with him for like 2 years. And because he was from Holland, it made things a little bit tricky. And I had to make a decision whether I was going to go and move over there because he had children. And I remember him saying to me, I'm going to open you a salon wherever you want. And he was very romantic. He used to carry me over 50 roses on a flight from Holland every weekend.
What?
Fabulous. Yeah, I used to give half of them to my sisters. But they were fabulous. And he was just very romantic. It was lovely. But after 2 years, it was really the case to decide, what are we going to do? Because we couldn't continue to do that. And I didn't want to move. I didn't want to give up my family and my friends and start a whole new life. At the time, I just didn't think it was right for me.
Okay. And you're the first 33 pages, and I know this because I have a friend going through a tough time with cancer at the moment. And when I read your book, the first 33 pages were how you dealt with your stage 4 diagnosis. And what I might do with this is take those 33 pages and we're going to talk about your cancer, maybe on a little bonus episode or, you know, on a little separate part of the podcast, because you were given a stage 4 cancer diagnosis. You were told basically, correct me if I'm wrong, that you hadn't, there was no hope that you were going to die, but you have survived.
That's right. When I went and found the lump, obviously, and then after further tests, they had said to me that all they could do was make me comfortable, and that I was going to die. So there was no worse news you can possibly hear. I think getting a diagnosis from cancer, that's the worst diagnosis you can possibly get.
How did you pick yourself up? Like, it was obviously you had an army of support around you, and everyone helped you get better. But I just, it's so different to my diagnosis, because I was given so much hope. I can't even, it's just such a testament to the person that you are, that you were able to pick yourself up.
But I don't think, like, I don't want anyone to think that that's who I was at when I got diagnosed. I wasn't. I absolutely went into shock, and I was devastated. And I honestly did think, what is the point in fighting? Because I'm going to die. And it did take me a few weeks to remember who I was.
Yeah.
And I think I was trying to work out, like, to how I got this. You know, I'm not a doctor, but I was trying to work out, what have I done wrong? Is it because I didn't have a child? Because it was an estrogen-based cancer. So I was just so confused to how I'd got this illness. So, yeah, I did. It took me, I was in dust. I didn't come off the hospital and was like, put me a superwoman cape on. There was nothing like that.
Mm-hmm.
Like, I honestly did not want to open my eyes. I wanted to die in my sleep. And I did not want to wake up to this nightmare that I was in.
Yeah, I think I'm always, I suppose, really conscious when people reach out to me and they're like, I've just been diagnosed, and I'm trying to give them hope. But I'm also trying to say to them, like, I didn't always feel hopeful. You know, it's okay to let it all fall down and scream the house down and be angry and feel rage. And it's so much easier 7 years later to say, oh, you know, do this or do that. But yeah, like, we'll talk about the cancer. And I swear to God, Nicola, when I read your book, we who have been diagnosed with cancer live in fear a little bit of it coming back. But by reading your book, I actually feel stronger.
That's
moving
good.
Forward every day with my life. And the fear isn't as strong or isn't as domineering as it once was for me.
That's good.
And that's the hope that you're giving people. So when did you find out then you were cancer free?
So I got diagnosed in the January, and on the January, it was actually, it was the 22nd of June, I knew the cancer had gone from my body. That's why it's so special, that week, for me, because obviously that's the week I feel personally I got a miracle. So it was that week I got the news that the cancer had, it was all gone from my body.
It's just 6 months later.
6 months later.
Wow. And you did chemotherapy.
Did everything, yeah.
But you also did alternative things, alternative medicine.
I did everything. I did everything. So I do get a lot of people asking me, like, what do you think it was? I get so many people asking me that. And I always just say the truth, and I say, I done absolutely everything there was, because I had no choice. You know, it was a full-time job. Mm. It was absolutely exhausting. It would have been so much easier to go to work.
Yeah.
But I didn't have a choice. I had to do it if I wanted to stay alive. And I really, you know, when you say, like, you give up your all, like, I knew if I had have not survived, I knew I'm giving this every single thing that's left in my body to fight with. I'd done everything that's possible that I could do to stay alive.
Wow.
It took me a little while now to get back on my feet. Mm-hmm. Like, you know, I was floored. I'd given it me all, and Jesus, it was like I'd ran so many marathons. You know, I was just exhausted. So it did take me a little while. So it was the following May that I went back on, I went on Tinder, and I swiped right.
On the wrong person.
On the wrong person.
So tell us a little bit about that week that you met Paul.
As soon as I met him, it was just that cheeky little message. I honestly felt like, you know, somebody, when you meet somebody, it's just, you can have a great conversation and a bit of crack. And that's what I got from the first message. You know, somebody with a good personality. We had a phone call then, I think that evening. And we ended up speaking for hours upon hours. It was just the way it should be, I think. So, yeah, from soon as we just spoke, it was like you couldn't shut the two of us up.
Wow.
Yeah.
Because, like, you're such an infectious person. Like, you're all love. Even, like, walking down the driveway, you know, I was worried because there's so many of my family members here. And I was like, is this going to be intimidating for her or is it going to be overwhelming? And you literally just embraced everybody. I think people instantly feel very comfortable in your presence. So I can see how a man could almost instantly fall in love with you. And that's, I think, what happened with Paul, was it?
I always believe I go to meet someone and I love meeting new friends.
Yeah.
And I obviously don't even think to kiss somebody. I always just think, do I initially, am I attracted to them? And I love personality.
Yeah.
But honestly, I honestly get on, I do love people. And I love getting to know them and having the chats. That's why I think I definitely should have been, I would have been a great interviewer. But I think I love having great conversations.
Yeah.
So I don't go for that reason. And then obviously I forget that. About a kiss or something like that. But I do think it's a very personal thing for me to let someone kiss me even. I think, you know, I have to really like someone. So, yeah, when it happened, I remember running over to the car. I was pulling away and he just stuck his head in my car and gave me a kiss because I think he thought I was going to friend zone him because that's how comfortable I would be with people. I just love chatting. So then he was like, can I bring you on a date tomorrow? And I was like, okay, we went on a date tomorrow, the next day. And it was just so easy. It was just so fun. I still didn't know whether I liked him as a boyfriend, yeah. I didn't know whether I was attracted to him, but I really liked his personality. I liked his sense of humour and he felt like a kind person.
Yeah.
He felt like as in a warm person and very open and somebody that had done some work on himself, which I was very attracted to that because I'd never been out with someone that was so open and that had ever went to therapy.
Yeah.
And so I was, because I'd already been to therapy myself from being sick. So we just found it very easy to talk to each other.
Yeah. And then I suppose in hindsight now, looking back, he probably knew exactly what to say and exactly how to present himself to become your ideal man.
Absolutely. Like, obviously, I'm learning that as well. So it's like, but I didn't know that at the time. Obviously, you're believing. Why would you not believe when somebody's speaking to you? Like, if you sat there with anybody in a conversation and second guessed a conversation when you walk away with somebody, you'd drive yourself nuts.
Yeah.
So I take people as face value. And it's like, for what reason? To this day, I still do. You know, that's who I am and that's who I continue on going to be.
Yeah, I love that has remained in you and he didn't take that from you. So would you say then your relationship with Paul and how it started was, I don't know, we hear this term now, love bombing. So when they're showering you with attention and gifts and dinners and becoming this perfect person, is that what he was doing, do you think?
I would say he did it in a different way. He wasn't about gifts. He loved spending all his time with you. He wanted to spend time with me. And he's very good at cooking lovely romantic meals. And, you know, it wasn't like we went on real expensive dates. It wasn't like that. I didn't need that, you know. As much as I would have likened that before, where I did always love going to nice restaurants and nice and send me nice flowers and stuff like that. But this was different, I thought. Oh my God, this must be how it feels when it is the right guy.
Yeah, well,
you know,
it's
I don't
one.
Need all this fancy stuff. I don't need it. I was showing him my side of life that I have learned, like just gone for walks on the beach, little picnics. He said, I've never done this in my life. So I had learned so much from being sick. The other side of life from that working and I was showing him a total different side of life and he absolutely loved this too.
Wow. Would you say then, because you'd been through cancer and maybe you didn't feel like you were vulnerable, but would you say you were a vulnerable person at that time? Now looking back?
I don't think I ever used that word vulnerable when I was sick. Because yeah. I would never want to be ever. I never wanted anyone to treat me differently, firstly. And if somebody, if I ever hear that word, I don't know. I just never ever wanted to be a sick person. So when I look back now, yes, I was. But if you asked me then, I would have never have said, I would have never have used that word. Yeah. Ever.
So everything was going well between yourself and Paul. And when do you think the first kind of like, you know, when you get that little kind of that moment, can you remember that moment where you just, you had a kind of second thought or there was a slight red flag? And I think you said in the book you didn't even know what a red flag was back then. I don't think any of us did we?
No, I definitely, like, even when they say now an ick, like, I don't think we ever spoke like that years ago. I got it loads of times, but I just never knew what it was. Now I really know what that is. But now I definitely think I seen small, really small red flags. Really, really small. And him saying stuff to me, they were red flags that I didn't listen enough to.
Mm.
Like, I always remember them and they stayed in my mind. And I never understood to why they stayed in my mind. I just thought it was a very sad thing that he said. And I thought my heart went out to him.
But like, what do you mean?
Like when he said to me, I just remember lying in bed and he said, please promise me you'll never leave me.
Mm.
And I said, why would I? Like, things are going amazing. Like, things are really going fantastic. And he said, everyone that loves me leaves me. And I remember feeling really sorry for him, thinking, but I did think, but why would people love him if he's such a great guy? So that little second thought in my mind in the moment, I thought, that's a strange thing to say. I've never heard somebody saying something like that.
Yeah.
But yeah, to me then, that wasn't a red flag. I chose to feel sorry for him, thinking, oh God, people leave him because he's obviously telling me different stories, that he's telling me he's the victim. So obviously I believed him, thinking, oh my God, like, he's just a really nice guy and somebody could fall out of love. But that's the stories he was telling me. So I did believe him at the time. I did, yeah.
And what was it like dating a guard? I don't think I even know any guards. Like, I've no friends that are guards or family members.
Yeah.
Like, anytime I see the guards,
I know loads now. Loads. Yeah. I didn't know anybody
in the opposite direction. Like, they kind of scare
it's
me.
Like, I used to hear my dad, like, you know, we'd be all in the car and there's so many children in our house. Like, obviously there's not enough seats for everybody in the car and stuff. So you're packed in the car. And my dad'd say, oh my God, be quiet now. Here's the guards beside us and stuff like that. And so we always grew up a little bit intimidated of the guards, thinking, you know, that's what I thought. But when he told me his job, I didn't think twice, because, like, I wouldn't care what somebody did. Honestly, I swear to God, it just depends on the person for me. So when he said it, like, honestly, yeah, the uniform does nothing for me. Mm-hmm. Even the fireman uniform. I don't know why girls get excited about that, because that does nothing for me. All them, a businessman in a suit, like, that would do more than a smell of aftershave. That would do it for me. Where, so, like, I'd see even the uniform in the wardrobe and I'd be like, oh God, I hope he doesn't put that on, because that would not do it for me.
That's the ick.
Yeah, where some girls think that's real attractive. Yeah, that would have been the ick, that ugly short, all them, that would, them navy trousers and stuff. So yeah, it didn't do anything for me whatsoever. But my sister did say, I always remember her saying, we were at a barbecue or a house, and she said, you must feel real safe, do you? And I said, what do you mean? And she said, because, like, going out with a guard, like, you must feel real protected and real safe. And I said, God, I never thought of it like that. But when she said it, I thought, I suppose maybe it is nice. I thought, actually, you know, it'd be great if I got a parking ticket or something like that.
Just a short break to thank Electrocell for supporting the Good Glow this season. So what do electrolytes do? It's such a good question, isn't it? Well, you don't need to be an athlete to take them. They simply help you stay hydrated by helping your body absorb and retain water, keeping you energized and refreshed. As often, essential electrolytes can be lost due to exercise, hot weather, travel, and other factors. Electrocell is available in three flavours, blackcurrant, lemon and raspberry, and orange. It's vegan friendly, gluten free, caffeine free, and GMO free. So pop into your local chemist or find even more information on electrocell.ie. And your family then, because obviously your family have seen you suffer. Like they've seen you on your knees where they thought they were going to lose you, and you survived and you got your life back. And then all of a sudden, Mr. Charming comes along and they must think Nicola has her happy ever after.
Yeah, I definitely think so. Because I taught on myself. Like I honestly did think of myself. Like I do remember that phone call ringing my mum, and I always remember getting all my shopping, thinking of fabulous clothes for my holiday, and going down to this great guy who was cooking me dinner, and he was a great cook. And I honestly just remember sitting at his counter with the candles lit and everything, and I remember thinking, wow, because it was so lovely and fresh and new, and there was no pain or hurt. You know, when you go into a beautiful new relationship and you can't even imagine hurting one another. It's so beautiful, falling in love. And I remember just thinking, oh my God. And he was like, show me your lovely new clothes. Like he was just into fashion as well, like me and stuff. And he was besotted with me. I could feel he was so madly, he was madly falling for me. And I was starting to like him too. But I just remember saying to my mum, I think this is it. And I've never said it, but I was like, I think this is it.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And I think it's when everyone else is really invested and really happy for you. And then when those little kind of red flags come in, it's really hard to even admit to yourself, like, maybe this isn't perfect. Maybe this isn't what I thought it was going to be. So when, can you remember, like, what would you say the first incident of you being like, oh no, like this is, he's not a good guy.
I think I felt a bit suffocated, you know. The phone calls was okay. It was still nice because we were still falling in love. But I just remember saying to my sister, we were out shopping, and I just said to her that I'm feeling a bit suffocated. And she said, you always get like this. And I was like, she was like, oh, you're not into him now, you know? You're getting bored of him. And I said, I'm not. He's just, I like him, but he's very... So you do start thinking, oh, maybe it is me then. You know, because when people want me to be happy too, and they're thinking, you're too fussy.
Yeah.
You know, so people are saying these things when you're feeling these things, and then you are doubting yourself, thinking as well, oh, I am very fussy. And he is, maybe, like, I do self-sabotage, and maybe this guy really likes me, and he only wants to spend time with me. Sure. Like, if it really works out, I have to live with someone. So you're doubting yourself. Is it you? You always go back to thinking, is it you?
Yeah.
So I think that's the confusion bit for people in a relationship like this. So I think I love to explain it from my perspective totally, to think that I wish there was this just one big red flag and there was a big argument, and there wasn't, because this is how it happens. It creeps in so small. He was like, even if I go on a night shift, I don't care even if you're getting up for work. I want us to spend an hour. I want to sleep in the same bed together. And I was thinking, oh my God, like this is so lovely, but I love my bed to myself. So I was like, I'm going to have to change a little bit. I am going to have to, like, this is it. And I can't ruin this either.
Yeah.
So you're just thinking, well, this is the way it does go in a relationship. So yeah, I think we got to the stage, we went to a wedding, and I wasn't drinking. I was trying to not drink after the holiday. I was trying to mind myself. And his vibe was different. He was different towards my friends. And he was making me feel really uncomfortable about my friends. And I just remember we left, and he let the door slam in my face, where usually he'd be such a gentleman, he'd be opening the doors for you. And we went home, and he just was continuing to argue and argue and argue. And it was a total different side, I seen. And yeah, he kept blaming me. He kept saying things to me as if it's my fault, like I'm being selfish. I always remember when we went back to my apartment from his home, because we loved being in his house. He had a lovely garden and stuff. And he was like, you're different when you're in your own house, aren't you? And I was like, oh, maybe I am. Am I a little bit, maybe I'm more comfortable because I'm back in my own house. But he was obviously noticing maybe I was more comfortable, but he was using it as if I'm different. So I know that sounds so silly to somebody, but do you understand the confusion in that when you're thinking, oh, am I being different towards him because I'm just so happy back in my own house, because I'm more comfortable, and maybe you would be a bit more confident back in your own surroundings. So it was small little things like that. And then it was obviously hard to plan to meet my friends because he was always, always planning something for us. He was always planning to do something together, or we're going to do this tonight. And my friends were obviously giving me the space to fall in love too. These all, everybody wanted me to meet somebody. All my friends were in relationships as well. So I think that does happen. You do spend a lot of time when you meet somebody, getting to know each other, and you're in that love bubble. So I definitely don't think people was suspecting anything. And I wasn't. So I definitely think it took a big argument for me to see a different side. I'd already spoke to my friend and I was telling her things, and she was saying to me, "Where are you?" We went for dinner and I looked exhausted. And she obviously was worried because obviously I'd been sick. And she was like, you look crap. And you know, only your friends and your sisters or family could say that to you. And I already felt that, you know. And I said to her, like, he won't give me a night of my own. And she was like, just tell him, you know. And I was like, I'm hurting his feelings. And she was like, where's Nicola? Where's the girl I know? And I was like, what do you mean? Like, I really like him. And usually people are saying I'm too fussy, you know, and I'm the one that, like, I'm not interested in because I'm looking for the faults. So this time I was thinking, well, I'm not going to keep looking for the faults. I'm going to look at all the good stuff, because I'd been sick. All these dreams that you think of getting married and having a child, they were all taken away from me a year before that. So I was thinking, maybe I have been always too fussy. So maybe I have to look for more of the positive stuff than looking for flaws in people, like as in a man.
Yeah. And after everything you've been through, it's like you could almost convince yourself like it's a good problem to have. Jesus, someone wants to spend time with me. Someone's in love with me. Someone's, you know, besotted with me.
Yeah, I felt great. Like, I felt good. And any man I've been with have been very nice and been. So I just love having good, deep chats, and I am a very honest person too. And I don't know, I definitely think it's my personality more than anything that I actually get on with men.
Yeah. So do you think then, like, as your relationship progressed, that, like you said, like, there wasn't one thing that raised a red flag, it was just a series of things. Like, was there a point or a first time where you just wanted to leave him and not get back together?
Yeah. Like, when he left my sister's home and he got very aggressive, my friend.
How long was this into your relationship?
It was a few months. Okay. It was a few months. And he wasn't, obviously, I had said to my friend when we went for dinner, and she had said it to him. She's like, you have to share her.
Yeah, that was the key in the book, wasn't it? That sentence changed everything. That was like the before and after.
It's very sad because, like, I really was delighted that my friend said it. And then my sister was like, oh, but you're probably hurting his feelings because you did say that too. And I'm always a bit torn because I try to stay, like, do the right thing, but be in the middle nearly as well and see it from both sides. So
tell us about that weekend then. Like, how did this come up?
So it was like, it was my friend's baby shower, and I drove in, and we ended up coming back to my sister's, and then we had a drink. He was getting in with all my brother-in-laws. So a few of my sisters were all really close in our family, so they were all coming for my friend also. And he'd been in touch with my brother-in-laws, so they had arranged to have a drink when we went to the party. So when I got back, he was already there. So, like, when any occasion, he was getting everybody's phone. He was asking my brother, like, do you want to go for a drink? Get to know. Like, he was really like, I thought this is great because, like, he's just real out there, a bit like me, loves meeting people too. So that night, yeah, I just remember my brother-in-law having to come down and get him to leave. And he snatched my car keys off the counter.
And this is after your friend said you have to share her.
Yeah. And he's like, he ruined it all himself, because he could have just took it as a joke and said, you're right, I've probably been robbing her too much. You know, so he just got so defensive, which there was no need, you know. And I was glad she did say it. So I thought he looked too angry, I'm going to stay here. And then the messages kept getting worse and worse. So this is the first sign of the real Paul to come out. I think you just, my sister and myself were just shocked because my friend had gone home. I went to bed. I turned my phone off. I turned the phone back on. And I couldn't believe he was threatening me. He was threatening me with photographs, even when we were in Ibiza. You know, the way you'd have something on, looking at getting ready to go out, and photographs, really, like photographs that you would have had to really put the phone down from behind me, looking out at a view over a balcony in Ibiza, to really get a photograph, the photograph that he had got of me. And he said, I'm going to post this all over social media. And he had threatened. So I was just, I was gutted. I was absolutely gutted. I was gutted because it was going so great. Like, there might have been one or two little things, but I just, honestly, I was like, it was sad. It was like, yeah, what did I say, the rug being pulled underneath you.
Yeah.
So my sister dropped me home and I said to her, don't come in. And he was in my apartment. And he was cleaning up my apartment from all the damage he had done. And he said to me that he's hurt his hand. You think he broke his hand. But this wasn't just like breaking a few glasses. This was like the way you see in the movies and somebody goes into somebody's home and deliberately sabotages the whole home to destroy someone's home. Like a bad cop. That's the only way you could describe it. Like everything in my whole apartment, like smashed my televisions and every single thing he destroyed.
Were you surprised when you saw that?
Well, obviously he had sent messages threatening me that he was going to do this. But I said to my sister, turn the phone off. Like, there's no way he's going to do this. Mm-hmm. Like, who in their right mind would do such a thing? So obviously I walked in and he'd obviously had done a lot, all the cleaning up already. And obviously I could have seen no television on the wall and yeah. And obviously I just went into my bedroom. I just said to him to leave. I said, I need you to leave. And he was upset and stuff. And I just took my stuff. I had to go to work. I just walked out of my apartment and left him there. I had nothing to say. What could you say? And he was like, I'm going to pay for all the damage. And so, yeah. That was the first, that was the beginning, yeah.
And I feel like I can understand the heartbreak of something unfolding like that, because you can't ever forget something like that.
You can't fix it. Like, it's something you could never dream of happening when things were going so well, that I never seen any anger in him or anything like that. Because he just had me all to himself, remember. This was the first time. Like, he'd been around my family and friends and stuff. But obviously, for my friend to say that, she must have triggered a nerve or something like that.
It's like a scar then. You can never unsee it.
Yeah.
So I presume, and don't let me presume something if it's not true, but like, do you go back because you believe that he'll never do that again?
I think... my friend's dad had died. My best friend's dad. And so what they do is they creep in. They know you're vulnerable. But there wasn't, for me, there was no forgiving this. To me, he said he's gone back to anger management. He's going to look for anger management, and he was going to therapy, and he shouldn't have left his therapy. And all apologies and everything else. But I still couldn't believe, I couldn't trust him. You know, it was too big. And then when my friend's dad died, he kept ringing me and being very, very, very persistent. He wasn't taking no for an answer. So he asked me to go to his therapist with him. So I said, okay, I'll do that. And I went and I made him listen that I don't want to be in a relationship with you. It's over. Leave me alone. Because I did think sitting in front of another professional, because he's not listening. Yeah. You know, he's not taking this in. He's like, I don't want to hear it from me, he was saying. And he wasn't going to accept it. So basically, yeah, I had to go to I went to the therapist and the man said, do you hear what she's telling you? But I knew his, I seen a different look across the table because we were in the man's home, this therapist's home. And I just remember this look because he wasn't getting what he wanted. And I even felt a little bit unsafe going to the car.
Mm.
And I remember that. And my friend's dad had died. So he was like still coming, still popping his head up, still coming, still at my door, still calling.
And he was able to change the subject. He Absolutely. Was able to turn the attention away from what had happened and to Nicola, I need to support you. Yeah. You know, you're going through a terrible time. And it was that timing for him was had come along at the right time.
Yeah, and then I think when somebody dies and you think, oh God, this is a real problem.
Yeah.
Like obviously, like we both know when you get diagnosed, it's like, that's what you call a real problem.
Yeah.
So I don't know. It's obviously one of my biggest regrets. Like I do have regrets. Of course I do. I wish I had ran so far away. And I don't know how far he would have let me go. But I definitely think he crept back in there around that time. He was very good at manipulating you. He was so good at being on his, he was being so kind. And he was back to that amazing guy. Like, remember, I got one night of that, of the angry Paul.
Mm.
And for every other day, I had the most romantic guy. And then I was thinking, okay, he messed up. He messed up massively. Can I forgive him? Because I didn't know whether I could forgive him. Honestly, I didn't know. And I told him that. I said, I don't think I, it's too big. It's just so big. I don't think I can forgive it. And he got me a television and, you know, but I could still see the scratches on my floor, you know, like deliberate scratches and stuff like that from glass. He used the glass from the TV to actually destroy all my wooden floors and stuff, which is nuts. But yeah, he crept back in.
Yeah. And the abuse and everything took such a dire, horrible turn. And we'll get into it. But with that manipulation and with that abuse came the phone call to me from the guards to ask me to come to a Garda station close to where I live to discuss Nicola Haney and Paul Moody. And I Googled you.
Next week on the Good Glow podcast.
The manipulation got so bad that he had created a story.
From me being ashamed and from them messages a few years ago and me and you sitting on this sofa today. For anyone that reads it, I nearly feel like they're becoming my friend because they're in my mind, they're in my head and nobody, not even my family, and even they knew some stuff, nobody ever knew a lot of the stuff.
Thank you so much to Nicola for part one of our incredible conversation. I have linked her Instagram in the show notes of this episode if you want to reach out and send her a message. I know she would appreciate that so much. Thank you for tuning in. I'm so excited to bring the rest of the season to you and especially next week's episode, which is mind-blowing. I'll talk to you then. Thank you.